hovering on his shirt for an hour and a half, because that's how late Mindy was when she arrived. There were two streets that had the same name for some cockamamie reason. She was so shocked that I was so wasted that she still blushes when she talks about it. She drove us back to my house and left as I swayed a few feet from the front door by the TV room. I'll just sleep down here and watch these shorts I have to judge for the Blardy Blar Festival. And then I touched Jim's shoulder, and he must have thought I was going to say goodnight and thank you and I love you. What would I have done without you? But instead I threw up on him and myself. He ran upstairs to get towels, which I threw up into some more. I was cogent enough, though, to blurt out where the washing machine and dryer were, and able enough to make it to the bed where I was out like a light. The next day, I woke up to a fresh cup of coffee, a Vicodin, and a cast on my arm. A couple of my girlfriends, Leanna and Keisha, had come upstate to get away from the city and the demands of being artists in the fashion world. They were just barely surviving the Big Apple, which was more the Big Applebee's, wait for it, home of the crave and land of the greed. They sat in my screened-in porch, relaxing with handmade scented candles and essential oil perfumes that Keisha had made. Sandalwood, Lang Lang, wild orange, lavender. They were like me and could land or plant themselves anywhere. I sipped my upper, swallowed my downer, and back up the ladder I went. My friends couldn't stop me, and it was the last bit of work. With my left hand, I painted, and I kept my right arm raised above my heart, like the doctor said, like I knew the answer in class. Fonzie charged through the front door and do-si-do'd with Jim, who made a fast exit. Fonzie barrels into every room he enters. Several months before, he'd barreled into my apartment, throwing his carry-on bag to the floor and hugging and kissing me, darling, darling, darling. He then stepped back from me with intent, like an animal in the jungle listening for predators. He circled his arms three times in the air, like a magician doing hocus-pocus, but even bigger and faster. After the first time, he said, "My bag," and looked around. The second time, his arms swung fast again, "My bag." The third time, bent even further, "My bag," in umpire position. I'd never met anyone who'd forgotten a bag at an airport, so this was pretty funny. We drive to the airport the next day, and what was lost would be found. Fonzie did take very good care of me before we went to the city to see a serious doctor. We watched the Woody Allen documentary on Netflix, and I built fantasies to fend off my fear of working with him. Penelope Cruz talked about how she thought she was going to be fired. There were scenes on set of Woody directing and Josh Brolin looking handsome and brooding, sitting in a kitchen while Naomi Watts laughed at Woody and batted her eyes, looking thin and gorgeous and blonde. She gushed about the letter she'd received from Woody, asking her to act in his movie, so charming and witty that she had it framed. I'd gotten a letter too, but my letter wasn't frameable at all. It was very meh. Naomi's was 100 watts. Fonzie had brought me Plastic Academy Awards that he'd gotten from LAX. Best Actress, Best Woman, Best Sweetheart, Best Secretary, Best Mother. He drove me to my wrist surgeon in a downpour. He'd driven an ambulance in his 20s, and even found a servant's bell for me to keep at my bedside. He got me ready for baths and stacked towels for me to prop up my elbow with. He was at his best in a mode of high stakes, an emergency where he could come to the rescue. The high stakes mode was familiar and special for both of us. He reminded me of Erich von Stroheim, the great silent film director. He was an actor, too, and played Max von Meyerling in Sunset Boulevard, the former director, husband, and servant to Norma Desmond. He was arguably the greatest silent film director there ever was. There's a great documentary about him that you can watch on YouTube called The Man You Love to Hate. His cinematographer said that he loved realism so much that he made his actors hate him. He'd scream at them, "Fight, fight, I want you to hate each other as much as you hate me." He was interested in how men and women conquered their passions or how their passions conquered them. And this was racy stuff back then and it's racy stuff now, but he was an artist and realism was his passion. He even shot in Death Valley when it was 125 degrees and everyone had to stay there, obviously. No one could sleep because it was so hot. One of the caterers died there. This was the movie Greed, which confronted systems of capitalism and marriage. I saw it at the Film Forum in New York, the studio version. Stroheim hated the edits the producers had enforced instead of it. The man who cut my film had nothing on his mind but his hat. His version was 10 hours long, and although he knew he was making a masterpiece, he also knew he was making a financial flop, and he didn't care. He met Gloria Swanson when she produced and starred in the silent film Queen Kelly and asked him to direct. There's a scene where Swanson and a group of nuns from a convent pass a Calvary from some mythical kingdom, and when they meet the prince, they curtsy. Well, while shooting the scene, Gloria Swanson's pantaloons happen to drop down around her ankles. She was, of course, mortified, and all the guys laughed at her, but she rose to the situation with her dignity and stepped out of her pantaloons, then threw them at the prince. He caught them and then put them to his face and smelled them, saying, ah, and smiling. Stroheim loved this moment. So this is what the scene became. I mean, that would probably be scandalous today, right? So, the next day at Dailies, they watched it with the investor. He asked the cinematographer what he thought, and the DP said he'd liked it, and got kicked simultaneously under the table by Swanson and Stroheim. Gloria Swanson was concerned about the censors at the time, and Eric von Stroheim wanted to challenge the censors. He'd already shot orgy scenes that had nothing to do with the original story and turned the nuns to prostitutes, which was probably really artful and punk rock for him. I'm sure he got out of hand. There's a scene where she marries a man, and the part of the groom was turned into a drunkard. They were setting up the shot, and Stroheim had wanted tobacco juice to drip out of this man's mouth and onto her hand when he proposed to her. This was Gloria's limit, and she excused herself from set and went to her bungalow to call the bankers and share what the process of shooting had been like so far. She explained that Stroheim was manipulating the story, and she had not planned on playing a madam at a brothel, but a nun in a convent. How would that get past the censors? The slobbered tobacco juice on her hand from the man she was going to marry wouldn't get past the censors either. They'd only shot 20,000 feet of film, and if they continued in this way, the film wouldn't be completed for a year, and it would cost over $1 million more to finish. They'd already spent $600,000. And so the bankers flew to Africa the next day to shut down production. Can you imagine? Gloria Swanson produces the silent film and is taken from her and turned upside down and inside out. What was Stroheim thinking, and what was in his twisted genius? Where was his wife during all this? When Swanson and Stroheim met on the Sunset Boulevard set, they hadn't seen or talked to each other in 20 years. Stroheim had reservations about taking a small part in a film and questioned whether it was beneath him. He had become a character actor after the experience of Greed and lost much of his dignity as an artist, but luckily they welcomed him in France, where he worked with Jean Renoir as an actor in La Grande Illusion and collaborated with other French filmmakers. But in regard to this part, he concluded that the pain he had experienced as a director, having not worked in 20 years, was just as painful as the part of the butler. So he was on board. At this point, Gloria Swanson had also been forgotten about, so they shared this fall from grace. They met now, laughing and hugging each other with respect and appreciation for one another, and excited about the experience of working with the great Billy Wilder, who directed the film. I love that the small part wasn't too strong a blow to Stroheim's ego, and that it didn't prevent his attraction to playing it or any of his creative ideas that would go into it. Gloria Swanson talks about this in an interview I watched on YouTube. The script was yet to be completed when they were filming, so Stroheim had many ideas for his character and the story as a whole. He was back at his beginnings when he worked for D.W. Griffith as a first AD and character actor. He'd made his small characters memorable with distinct traits and wardrobe, things like an eye patch. He'd created so many villains that people loved to hate him. He was actually spat on and thrown out of restaurants, but he loved this persona since it created the necessary power and force to become a great director. He'd pitch as many ideas for his character to Billy Wilder, and Mr. Wilder would reject most of them because he didn't further the story, which breaks my heart. I would have loved to have seen another Sunset Boulevard from his character's point of view. He had a lot to give, and the one idea he had that made it into the movie was that the fan mail Gloria receives is all letters written by him. This idea made his character the heart of the movie, not only with his silent and tragic, unrequited love for her, but as her final director within the film. He's there at the very end, standing behind camera as she walks down that huge stairwell and into the lens, into all those wonderful people out there in the dark, on her way through us to the mental ward. If only I could weave baskets for the rest of my life. My psychoanalyst Mark says every director has a touch of sadism. I've been seeing him for well over a decade, and when I tell him my experiences, he says very simply, the business you are in is perverse. Like politics is corrupt, showbiz is perverse. People lie in politics, and there's perversity in showbiz, period. I was nervous to work with Woody Allen, since he'd been so steadfast to his psyche, both creatively and in his life. The heart wants what it wants. The pronouncement he made on 60 Minutes about his love for Sun Yi. It could be an aria from an opera, couldn't it? Any person left by their mother in childhood has an enormous weight and longing in their heart and soul, with a life spent recovering. If I didn't believe in the complexities of another's heart and soul, their story, their mystery, their truth, then I really would have to weave baskets. A culture that loses this becomes unhinged. It's the chewing gum, Mark calls it, that holds us together. Mark would compare Woody to Lewis Carroll, who we knew a little about. I didn't know Lewis Carroll suffered from a stammer, did you? 16. Gracie. She looks like Falcor, the dog from the Never-Ending Story, doesn't she? Her ears flap up and down when I walk her down the street, like she could almost take flight. I have this rope leash that I can clamp to a belt loop, and I think of it as an umbilical cord and of Gracie as a white shadow creature pulling me into pleasant thoughts and encounters. She's a Bichon Frise poodle Maltese mix, according to the vet. She is the energy in every situation we're in together, and people react in almost always positive ways. She deflects negative stuff coming toward me, and I see people's faces light up at how animatronic she looks, like she could start talking. Then they reflect this happiness walking past me, and I hear that dog was smiling at me a lot, which is the Bichon part of her genes. I learned that from the Westminster Dog Show. Gracie sits in my chair and watches me work on set, sometimes in the director's lap where she fits perfectly at the monitor, and sometimes curled up in her bag where she doesn't block the view. I'm in love with Gracie because that's what she's there for. She is a vessel of spirit for dark gaps in people, places, and things. Trained on wee-wee pads, she goes on corners of welcome mats as well as rugs. Her early years were spent in hotel hallways where she'd catch air as she leapt like a gazelle in her supreme agility as I'd lie on the floor and she'd hurtle over me. In dog runs and parks, she sits next to strangers and cuddles up or places her paw on them to show her devotion. She likes to stop at nail salons and barbershops to look inside because she's a poodle and she likes hair and nails. She likes makeup stores like Blue Mercury and prefers sitting at the entrance of doorways. Like the Anubis jackal from Egyptian mythology, the central figure in the journey through the underworld. The paparazzi adore her. The paps, or the paparazzi, as she refers to them. Strangers ask to take her picture and she gets a lot of hits on Instagram. I put her into the arms of people when they look like they want to hold her. So yeah, she's working all the time. She was attacked by the press, though, and suffered greatly after being unfavorably written about in Gawker. She called the site Barker, saying it was all bark and no bite, but I knew she was hurt on the inside. They called her a devil dog, and to this day, people still say that they heard she was mean, and it's clear that she's not and wasn't. Lena Dunham told me that they called her dog a devil dog, too. We were in the works to start a protest called Motodokad, which stands for Mothers of Dogs Against Defamation of Character of Dogs, but people got in the way of it. Gracie stayed indoors for weeks after the shame of that fake news and became eccentric for a while and started wearing wigs. She took the bait of the hate talk and started biting back. But this was when she was younger and took things personally. It sounds crazy, but the other's voice became her own so easily that it would wreck her spirit. as she chewed the wedge cork heels of my favorite slipper shoes. "I'm not a devil dog. That's not me," she said, almost foaming at the mouth. She was upset and angry. "Dog spelled backward is God. What blasphemy." She started to cry, and I picked her up and said, "Calm down, blessed creature, little lamb." I held her by her armpits and looked her in the eyes. "If you let them hurt your feelings, you let them win, cake batter." She loves when I call her this, but she was still devil-dogging and twisting and turning. "Listen," I said, "they have to keep their website going because old-school journalism is almost out the window, and they're just trying to make a living in this strange culture we have right now. Just see the big picture. Don't attach yourself to the fiction of what they wrote. It's all fiction anyway, Gracie. Keep working on the Rough Times blog about your early years at the puppy mill and make your own fiction." She let out a growl, and I lifted her high into the air with one arm in the I'm the boss position. She was still frustrated, so I calmly said, "Relent and restore your spirit, Gracie. Recover, Butterbones." She started to let go of her anger, and her body became softer as she felt the sadness. Why do people like to read about things that are made up and mean? I was holding her like a baby at this point and swaying and twisting, humming to her. We were in the bathroom because she'd said she'd wanted to wash her face and put on makeup. In the reflection of the mirror, I saw the pills that were stuck in the crevices of her paws pads. I squeezed her wrists to release her grip and flushed them down the toilet. She said she just wanted to take the edge off and had no intention of doing anything drastic. She's much more mature now. She's 14 and in her regal years and still does her job beautifully, being devoted to me and other people. She was somewhat of an impulse buy, but I've been pining for a dog and looking at websites like Fur Babies to rescue a pet and was well into my expecting years. I just didn't know when she'd appear. My boyfriend at the time, Ryan, wanted a cat. I'd given him a sleeping cat from Chinatown for Christmas, the kind made of rabbit fur that has its little eyes closed and comes curled up, forever sleeping. For a few weeks, the cat was asleep in the windowsill, until he slept on the wall in my bedroom, attached with Velcro, high up and flying in the air, holding a piece of red yarn with the big ball of yarn stretched 6 feet away from his paws. It was not good feng shui, per se, but it was my feng shui at the time. I'd wait around late nights for my rock star boyfriend to come home while he was out, catting about, making music. Ryan Adams, not to be confused with Brian Adams. He makes beautiful music. He'd recently fallen off stage and broken his wrist and needed surgery, just like I'd have years later. His right hand was filled with pins and screws, and he had to learn to play guitar again, which he would have no problem doing, and go on to record maybe 10 more albums. Anyway, it was snowing, and we bundled up and journeyed out to the game store in the West Village to buy a puzzle, and there was a pet store next door called Grimorama. Ryan wanted to look at the cats, but I was allergic to cats as a kid, so their mystique never interested me. It was there, in Grimorama, that I saw Gracie, nestled in her cage. I couldn't believe she hadn't been taken and asked to hold her, and she pressed up to my very heart like a magnet and whimpered longingly. It was time to have a baby, and so I did. At 5:02 in the afternoon, on October the 11th, 2004, I became a mother. It was an easy labor, there in the pet store in the West Village, where it was fated to be. Gracie is a Libra with a moon in Scorpio, which is my sun sign. She traveled on subways in her bag as soon as she could. I was determined not to raise a nervous wreck like I was at her age, and I didn't. I guess Gracie was around 8 when I ran into a friend on the sidewalk in my neighborhood, a very reputable woman, talented and not woo-woo at all. She was carrying her beloved dog, Bitsy, not a real name, who was sick. She had taken her to the vet a few times, but decided to meet this pet psychic, Claire, who came highly recommended by other people, and I'm assuming dogs as well. Anyway, Claire diagnosed Bitsy's health issue. My friend was mystified and relieved, since the vet had gotten it all wrong and the psychic hadn't. I, of course, asked for Claire's number. It was the holiday season, and for Christmas, I wanted to hear what Gracie had to say. There was nothing wrong with Gracie, but she did bark a lot when someone came over, and I'd have to say to my guest, "Sit down in a chair so she can greet you." When Claire came over, she was so nice and ethereal. How can you not be when you can hear dogs talk? She started her work right away and was miming, chewing, and moving her mouth around and asked, "Does Gracie mainly chew on the left side?" "She does. There's a tooth that bothers her," Claire said, and then sat down on the couch with us and Gracie sat next to her, putting her paw on her knee. She explained that Gracie had been a 7-year-old English girl in her last life and that manners were very important to her and whoever came into the home needed to sit down first and basically start telling her fairy tales and put the kettle on for some tea and make her a crumpet or cut the crust off white bread for cucumber sandwiches. Claire started licking her lips like she was tasting something. "You know what really makes her happy? Peppermint candy. She has a sweet tooth." Now, when Gracie was a puppy, she was compulsively sniffing gum off the sidewalks and trying to remove it in order to chew or eat it. I tried for a while to train her to chew gum and spit it out, but after she swallowed it a few times, I stopped. She would get into my purse or a friend's purse and chew their mint gum. Claire said Gracie loved ice cream. Well, guess where I take her when it gets warm out? Down the street for a dollop of my own peppermint ice cream at Sundays and Cones, where I share some with her. Please don't repeat this. I'm only telling you this because we'll never see each other again, but I'm at the window seat, so I'm the dreamer. What person doesn't want to imagine a dog's thoughts? I introduced myself to this actor who's at a big show at Sundance. I'm not saying who it is. And he goes, "I've seen you walking around the neighborhood. You have a weird relationship with your dog." I could have said, "Well, you have a weird relationship with women," but I didn't, even though I know he does. I don't trust people who don't like dogs, but I trust dogs who don't like people. When people say I'm not really a dog person, all I hear is I'm not really a person. Some actors are like snipers who hide in the trees and wait to undermine you with mind games as they fight for close-ups or ruin yours and are having fun while they're actively conniving, like some kind of reptile person. There's something so dark and twisted about them. And because they're so good at being this other thing, it's not really a person. People love watching them. I worked with one of these snake-like sniper actors and experienced the black cloud that came with him and the ravens that flew around him. He really created an energy of deep perversion. I saw him again when I was trying to meet Johnny Knoxville because I had a script I was trying to produce about Ted Kaczynski. It was at a premiere party at the Jane Hotel, and I sat on the floor in front of the fireplace. Johnny never showed up to the thing. I had planted myself in Michael Shannon's roped-off area and met Mary Stuart Masterson from Some Kind of Wonderful, who was happy and kind and told me about a film production facility she was pioneering upstate to boost the local economy up there. It was a different kind of movie party than we were used to, filled mainly with suits and indiscriminate but loud music, and hardly any familiar faces. People used to have fun at these things and let loose, but now you were easily watched and even monitored. Michael Shannon arrived with his friends, and I stood up to introduce myself and asked if it was all right to sit in front of the fireplace, and he was cool about it. He's a big, handsome presence of sensitivity and force and sat low in the velvet couch like a king, with his hands on his knees as they jutted out. He asked how I was and what I was working on, and I told him new media ideas, new forms, and I may have mentioned my dog's playing poker idea and remembered asking him to imagine what it's like being an actress, to be like you, but a woman in these times. It was good their drinks came, and while I was sitting there, not 30 feet away, I saw the sniper snake man. His reptilian head slowly moved, and I read his lips. "Is that Parker Posey?" he mumbled to the woman next to him. My hand swept a big wave, like I was on shore, and I said loudly, "Yeah, it's me!" I kept waving my arm back and forth as I registered his face, turning me to camouflage. I got up, and as I walked over, I watched him pretend to rack me into focus and said, "Yeah, it's me, Parker, hi!" He acted surprised, and I quickly introduced myself to the woman and then excused myself, saying I was going to the bar. Standing at the bar waiting for the bartender, I saw a producer I'd worked with recently. When we made eye contact, his face showed no recognition, so I said, "It's me, Parker." He was deep down some dark corridor and said darkly, "I know." It was going to be one of those conversations that took some work. I said, "We've worked together." The corners of his smile lifted with an effort of curling dumbbells. He introduced me to his friend, a much younger actress, and his spirits brightened. She didn't recognize me or my work, despite a long list of movies I spouted out quickly, and then, to lighten the awkward situation, I pulled out my iPhone saying I was going to IMDb myself. Then the producer said, "She's coming around." People say such weird things to you when you're famous. Like you're not a person, but something else, like a cardboard cutout version of yourself, wearing a mirrored mask. I could have passed out onto the floor as if waiting for an ambulance to arrive. That way he could have looked to the party people while holding smelling salts under my nose to say, "She's coming around." He could have lifted my wrist in the air like an old boxing veteran. "She was a champion back in the day. She's coming around." And I could have lifted my arms in a rah-rah gesture, fist-pumped the air. I could have said, "No, I'm not coming around. I'm the ghost of Christmas past. But you don't recognize me because it's not the holidays." I could have stuck my elbows out and windshield wipered my hands, twisting sharply and saying in robot voice, "Your credit card is not working. Your credit card is not working," as many times as I wanted until everyone left. But instead I said, "Ah, I wish they allowed dogs in here." And then I felt the tug of Gracie's rope leash pulling me at the waist to her dog star, Sirius, the brightest star visible from any part of the earth. 17. Garbage on the beach. I learned the Mysore practice of yoga when I was in Berlin working on Hal Hartley's movie Fagram. Yeah, you do get sore from Mysore, but it's the fundamental self-practice yoga, which if you learn it, you can practice anywhere all over the world. And since Mysore is the basis of all yoga, if you can do Mysore, you can do any other yoga class. Ugh, my, I'm sore. My teacher's name was Andreas Schnitger. He was in his early 30s and had trained in India with Patabi Joyce, who founded the practice, and was intensely dedicated. He always wore the same thing to practice, tight black sweatpants with a white shirt and black sweatbands on both his wrists. And if this wasn't cool enough, he played jazz drums in an experimental avant-garde jazz band. When I asked if I could come to a show, he said I probably wouldn't like it, that it was mainly noise and very loud. J'adore. A dedicated yogi makes music I wouldn't understand. Avant-garde jazz drummer. Far out. He was so cool. I started with the primary series, which is where you begin. Learning when to breathe and how to breathe is an integral part of yoga. There's just so much breathing. Yes, that's right. We are breathing the air at this moment, but I mean conscious breathing. Andreas spoke English really well, but carefully, and he liked to say, "free breathing." I think he must have liked the elongated E sound, because German is not a language that relaxes its vowels. When I tried to speak it, I had to purse my lips and push the O sound to the front of my teeth. I did that terrible thing where you imitate the accent of the country you're in, and it's annoying for everyone except yourself. Maybe that's why I wasn't invited to the jazz club. Anyway, Andreas said free breathing a lot. After a few sessions, he caught on that I thought this was weird, and he said, "You don't like it, free breathing?" "I do, it's nice," I said, "but breathing, being free, I don't know, it's not like you charge someone, like, money to breathe. In English, it could sound like you're talking about commerce." But he loved it. "I like it. Free breathing." Like breathing is in jail and we need to free it from jail, like put it on a protest sign. "I like it," he said again. "Free breathing." Of course it's free, it's breathing. We eventually dropped it, put it on a protest sign. Andreas taught me private classes. When I wasn't working on the film, I'd walk to the studio a few blocks away from where I was living in Mitte and take class with not even 10 students. This was in wintertime, and Berlin was cold and snowy. The city didn't pour salt on the sidewalks because they were sensitive to the dogs whose paws would bleed if salted. So the snow never melted on the sidewalk, and you'd see people sliding and slipping and their dogs trotting along. Hardly any dogs had leashes, and they were allowed in restaurants and bars, and it wasn't a big deal. My apartment was small, which I liked, and had efficient, recycled, modern-type furniture. the shower curtain made of sewn-together plastic bags, a bed on the floor, and a chair made of plywood that looked like it would break if I sat in it, which it did. Yeah, I leaned back and it broke, so I didn't have a chair anymore. The place was simple, and it was a relief at that time in my life. I'd broken up with Ryan and suffered a betrayal when a girlfriend slept with my ex, and another friend was having drug problems and was being needy and crazy. Bye-bye, mein lieber Herr. Farewell, mein lieber Herr. It was a fine affair, but now it's over. So it was a great time for me to eat alone and listen to the music of a language I didn't understand and get my body moving to the Mysore Ashtanga yoga practice. Samasthiti, or mountain pose, is the starting position. You stand at the front of your mat with your hands at your sides and your eyes closed, neck aligned with your body, imagining a line or string of energy from the cosmos to the top center of your head, traveling directly down, straight to the center of the earth. Don't stick your belly out and become a hill. You find your center and pull it in like a strong mountain. Be still, I'll show you. Now you start the breathing practice. Breathe in on the count of four in what's called Ujjayi breath, and then breathe out. Do this through your nose only. If you don't know what Ujjayi breath is, contract your throat to sound like Darth Vader and breathe in. Now breathe out, sounding like him. Do it right now. Oh, who cares? You'll never see these people again. On the last count of this ocean breathing at the end of the breath, in that space before the final exhale, bring your hands to prayer position at your chest, your home, or heart center, they call it. This is where you start the moving of your hour and a half practice. When you move, your body becomes an architectural form, traveling through space, angles, symmetry, harmony on the earth. It becomes a vessel which the elements of nature pass through within your mind's thoughts or meditation. Yoga is the practice of the body so that it can become light, providing your thoughts with light, so they don't stick to ideas that the mind creates for itself. You want your mind to float, or to at least create more distance from its attachments. In class with Andreas, when I put my hands to my chest in prayer, my mind got quiet enough to hear a meditative voice say, "You're home. You've been running so much." Tears fell down my face and onto my mat like rain. This is not unusual, and if you're not drunk, I think it's kind of fabulous to be free enough to cry in front of other people. Yeah, it's written all over you that you cry when you fly. There's a quote from the writer Joseph Campbell that I love because it's easy to remember. "I don't have faith. I have experience." My Uncle Tim turned me on to Joseph Campbell with The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers, which was on PBS when I was around 18. I really dug it. Uncle Tim died of an overdose when I was in my 20s. He'd become addicted to opiates over the years, and the trauma of Vietnam had been like a powder keg inside him. He also raged against small-town religious conservatism and returned to Shreveport to confront Nani, to find the mother within, but she wasn't easy with her heart because her feelings probably scared her. She'd become an icy queen. As I stood there in mountain pose, more memories and repressed feelings came up. The biggest thing probably was that I recognized myself or my life. I stood there in prayer with hands at my heart center and just felt my life up to that point. I saw the speed of my life and all this running, how I'd grab onto parts in my work as if it were real, as if it were something I could hold on to. I just wanted to be distracted and absorbed at the same time and have it be about something or someone else. I was reaching outside myself, mostly. It's so weird because I really want to disappear and acting allows for that, but at the same time you can see me on the screen on this airplane. Anyway, I started to realize stuff. I heard my inner voice saying, "It took you so long to get here, but it's okay." It takes courage to live a life, is something Mildred would always tell me. You have to take courage, though. It can't just be an idea. Hold on to yourself, she said repeatedly. And anyway, it was on the yoga mat where I held on to myself. Stop digging when you find yourself in a hole. Just cut that string. Free breathing. Put the shovel down. Isn't the dirt great around this mountain? Isn't this view amazing? So the first movement you will do is part of what's called the vinyasa flow, and it's the sun salutation. Okay, I'm getting up. Your hands move up while you breathe in on the count of four with your still steady ujjayi breath. And you reach your palms over your head. Your arms have made the circle of the sun. The movement or gesture is a worship to the sun. Again, a slow, deep breath. On the next count of four, you bend forward as your arms brush down and past the landscape in front of you. Then your palms are placed directly in front of your feet as you fold into a sandwich bend, a completed bow to the sun. If your palms don't hit the ground, don't worry. It's not a competition. Be calm about it. You see your limit and acknowledge it and get over it. On the next count of four, look up to see the horizon. And then bow your head down on the next count of four. Forehead on your shins again. Another bow to the sun. The first big move comes next. Your feet step or jump behind you to push-up position. Or chaturanga. Or chaturanga. You somewhat float down to the floor for just a millisecond, landing with your torso an inch off the floor, your arms and toes holding you up. You scoop up to a back bend with a long inhale. And then you're positioned facing up like a seal. On the count of four, the breath of your nose comes shooting out again like water from a well's spout. And then you push your butt into the air and make a triangle above the earth. You settle into Adho Mukha Savasana, or downward facing dog. I met a standard poodle named Jackie O at the Chateau Marmont who did this posture on command. In this posture, breathe four long breaths again. If you were going to practice with Pattabhi Joyce, the father of Mysore, you spend months practicing only the sun salutation. The next move is the first big sweep with your foot. Begins with the right foot. With your left foot planted at a solid quarter turn, swoosh your right foot back, the sound of a wave. Then swing it forward. And plant your foot in front of you. In a forward-facing lunge, your arms come up, tight to your head, palms in prayer, the pointed arrow of a bow reaching up to the sky. This is Virabhadrasana, or Warrior One. Yeah, sure, come through. The sound of the foot swooshing, like the sound of a wave, was an Andreas touch from his own teacher. I like it. You know, the body can be fluid. All that's inside us moves around like water. You hold Warrior One for 4 oceanic Star Wars breaths, then slide out to Warrior Two for another set of Ujjayi breaths. Okay, I'm going to sit back down. At this point, it may not sound like it, but you're already sweating. This whole time you've been cleaning the garbage on the beach, as Andreas would say. The voices that chatter, those awful scenarios, the voice of judgment, like stale, hard gum, spit it out, with all the other garbage on the beach. The waves come and wash that gum away, along with those faded Budweiser cans and strips of dirty plastic beach crud. Then look at the horizon. Look at the view. Ugh, the garbage on the beach has come back again. My shit, my work, my stress, this beach is a mess, the world is a mess. Clean this garbage on the beach. And then you get calm again. Centered. A nice wind, while in Warrior Two, has come to blow the garbage away, allowing inner peace. Leaves blow by, not indigenous to this tropical climate. C'est la vie. Au revoir, Shane. Tschüss. One day during my moon time, Andreas led me through a private yin class and guided meditation. In yin class, you hold postures that are mainly on the floor, but you still get sore. He brought over some yoga blocks and blankets and an eye pillow. I sat cross-legged in meditation pose on the yoga block so I wouldn't hunch. I closed my eyes. I want you to picture yourself as a 5-year-old sitting in a chair, he said. You are looking at yourself in this chair. When the child moves, it is a thought coming up. You ask the child to sit in the chair. My 5-year-old self was monkey-brained, examining the chair, walking around it, curious, distracted, laughing, crying. This played on a loop quickly in my mind's eye. I found myself telling the child to sit in the chair over and over again, holding her little hand, walking her to the chair, gently gesturing for her to sit and be still. Before I knew it, the hour and a half had flown by, so there was peace found. When I opened my eyes, I saw Andreas looking at me as if in a daydream. His teacher position had dropped. I'd like to follow you for a day, he said, to see what it would be like to be you with your dog and to be free. Not long after returning from Berlin, I'd come home from a baby shower for a college friend, and I was feeling sad and blue. At the shower, I'd seen an acquaintance, a woman around my age, a writer, and she'd seen me in something. Anyway, she blurted out about the other actress in the film she saw. Why does she wear a wig when it makes her look old? She quickly covered her mouth, embarrassed, and said that was an awful thing to say. I shrugged and made it all right, despite spiraling into thinking about all the talk that goes on behind my back. She probably just likes the wig and, you know, doesn't want to sit in the makeup chair every morning and be fussed over. Someone pulling your hair at 6 a.m. for an hour, sometimes for months at a time, it's not that fun. Then I decided to be more direct or honest and told her how I remember seeing Susan Sarandon talking about aging on television, how after the age of 40, women are just ignored. She ended that conversation and said, well, you were great in that movie, and I said thank you. The snowy night in the city had me feeling like a lone figure in a snow globe. When I got home that night, I couldn't wait to cry. The suffering produced some garbage on the beach. I want to hide forever. New York is competitive and harsh, and it's not the same anymore. Everyone wants something. Everyone has to be so smart, interesting, or fascinating. Why do some conversations feel like I've given blood? The wind was dramatic and then settled, and then I saw an IV tube and went to the ocean to rinse it. Oh, look, there are Andreas's black warm-up pants and his wrist sweatpants. I went online to find a local yoga class. There was one at Jivamukti with a teacher I didn't know. I took a fun class at a workshop there once, and on the last day, the teacher had us close our eyes and find the tops of our mats with our feet and then stand on tippy-toe and click our heels 3 times and say, in unison, "There's no place like Om. There's no place like Om. There's no place like Om." I joined in for half a second and then just looked around to see if anyone else thought it was too silly or was too cool to do it and exchanged a few looks. I started at the top of my mat in mountain pose, Samasthiti. Then I started my 4 breaths on the count of 4. Earth, wind, fire, Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, and water. I put my hands to prayer at the heart center, home. Then came the sun salutation, arms up to the sky. The sun always comes up. My hands reaching out over the space. Then down on the count of 4, bowing down, the sun goes down. I put my head on my shins, jumped back, chaturanga, swooping up, my back bent like a wave. The water rushes out. I looked up and my emotions, like a wave, splashed out into the air. Goodbye. I pulled back in the downward-facing dog and receded from them as I breathed out. Next came 4 long Darth Vader breaths. I am your father. And on the count of 4, the first big sweep into Warrior 1. I brushed my right foot against the mat, making the sound of the ocean like Andreas taught me. Well, the yoga teacher was standing directly behind me, and his legs were open in a standing V, and during that oceanic brush, the arch of my foot, the shape of a curved wave, briefly cupped his package, and I thought, sea anemone. I fell to the floor, grabbing my belly and laughing so hard, rocking with laughter. I looked around to share the moment, but no one saw it, or if they did, they pretended not to. I was in the back of class, so I knew people saw it because they'd have been looking through their legs when it happened. The yoga crowd can be a tough house. I said something to the teacher, like, "Never in my life," and he said, "Well, there's a first time for everything," which made me laugh even harder. First time for everything, like laughing in asana. There's no place like Om. 18. I'm a vegan. Places hold a certain karma when you visit them, and I like to think it's written in the stars. Neosporin is good to stick up your nose when you're flying because it prevents germs, but no matter what precautions I take, when I spend time in LA, I can almost guarantee that I will throw up while I'm out there. Whether it's a bug in a salad or some germs on a doorknob, the place has weird karma for me. The stories are always funny later, of course, and if you're with someone with a sense of humor, they're laughing even before you get sick. Like when I was dating Harper Simon and teetered in front of a yellow Lamborghini outside the Roosevelt Hotel and he joked about throwing up in the car and knew the minute I ate the Roosevelt's delicious hot rolls that some dirty bug had got me. But the tables turned on Harper when I jammed a wax earplug too far into my ear and he spent a good half hour digging for it with a pair of tweezers. It's such a small world that I bet you know someone who has seen me get sick in L.A. I was needlepointing on a flight to L.A. once and chatted with a flight attendant who also needlepointed. And then 10 years later, maybe more, I met her again on a sidewalk in the desolate outskirts of Salt Lake City where loads of flight attendants live. She was taking a walk around the neighborhood, and we met after a physical therapy appointment for my wrist. She recognized me and smiled, saying, "The needle pointer." The mountain was so close in proximity, In Manhattan, it would have been as far as the distance between the Village and Midtown. It was just majestic. She lived in an apartment complex built in the 50s, by a tiny dentist's office where a large, smiley-faced sign on the front lawn jutted up to the sky. We chatted about the small world, and she recommended a vegetarian place that I never made it to. I try being a vegetarian. So many cool people are. But I guess I come from too many ranch hands. I don't eat meat all that much and make a lot of soups and salads. But too much food talk starves a good conversation. Kale isn't as popular as it used to be, and I don't know why that is. I don't go out to LA as much as you think, but I do for meetings every few years. During one trip in the aughts, I would hear, "I don't really eat," just minutes after being introduced to someone. It started to seem like a surname for beautiful young actresses. It's different today, isn't it? Back then, that was the jargon. Women are starved, the culture is starved, the minimum wage is starved. Maybe all the food talk has to do with the amount of shit sandwiches everyone in the biz has to eat. You know what a shit sandwich is, right? When you have to eat the bad news as shit, but it's made with the best bread and cheese available. Sometimes it's served to you with so much crap that you don't even know you're eating it. "They love you" is probably my favorite bologna made of crap I've ever eaten, because it's said a lot and sounds so good. "I'm a vegan" started to sound like a surname too, and I'd be smart to start practicing my vegetables. I started to do this thing by substituting the word kale for care, as in, "I don't kale where we eat. I kale too much, that's my problem." I also started doing this thing when I drove around that is completely obnoxious or funny, depending on who you are and how you feel. I roll down my window, get a person's attention on the sidewalk or crossing the street, and call out, "Excuse me, are you a vegan?" Or I got the attention of someone in a car at a stop sign and said casually, but a little too loud, "I'm a vegan!" This was more fun in the passenger seat when I get to hang out of the car. It was good, clean fun, unlike veganism, which is hard work. I get this from my parents, doing silly, unexpected stuff. One time we went on a trip and my mom wanted to stop at a mall for a shopping fix, so we went into a store called Spencer's and bought some plastic masks. My dad wore a Nixon one, I remember. My mom was a pig. They'd put them on as they drove and we'd see who they'd freak out, laughing until we made ourselves tired. It wasn't cool anymore to drink in the car, so that's how they replaced their fun. Not really. They still drank in the car, but in moderation. I really did try to live out in Los Angeles, for a few months anyway, but I'd read too much Dominic Dunn and books about Manson, which made L.A. not a friendly place. Being a New Yorker by this point, I wanted to see more interaction with people on the sidewalks and would think, where did everyone go? What happened to everybody? When someone asks to go on a hike, which happens a lot out there, I get suspicious and a little scared. When they say take a hike, I walk away. On a recent visit, I just landed and was waiting for my friend Craig to get back from therapy. He lived in one of those 1930s Beechwood Canyon apartment buildings that housed actors back in the day, and I sat on the grass in front of his building in the sun with Gracie. You could see the Hollywood sign when you drove up that street. I recognized a neighbor of his walking his dog. We'd met on the sidewalk on a previous visit, and we chilled out, having that New York versus L.A. conversation. Eventually, one of us noticed that some man had his car parked up the driveway outside the building's garage. He was sitting in his SUV, and it looked like he was staring at us hatefully, like a murderer or a Quentin Tarantino character. It was so intense that we both denied that he was staring at us, and we looked behind to see if he had to be looking past us at something that had possibly angered him, giving him that sour look. But there wasn't anyone there. He had to be looking at us. We made up excuses. His car stalled. He's having trouble seeing. We chatted a little and looked again. Maybe his window was tinted so dark that he was squinting to see through it. We chatted some more. Wait, he was wearing sunglasses. If his windows were too dark to see through, he would have taken off his sunglasses. After almost 10 minutes, I got up to ask this man if he was okay. When I approached his car, he asked me if I was a homeless person. I was polite and easygoing. No, I'm not. I have a home in New York, in fact. I just landed in L.A., but my friend Craig lives here, right there in that apartment. I pointed, all casual and cool. Well, you look like a homeless person, he said. Oh, well, thank you, I said, but I'm not. Is it my Indian sari on the grass? Because it's a beautiful scarf. I smiled back at it and looked at him again. I'm just sitting on the grass, you know? You can't sit on the grass. Who said you could sit there, he asked. I don't know, the good Lord. I thought we were all allowed to sit on the grass. Well, you can't just sit on the grass like a homeless person, he said. I'm calling the cops. He didn't, but that would have been a better story. That kind of thing has never happened to me in New York. I got stopped and pulled over in the 90s, swarmed, actually, by 6 or 7 cop cars in West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. The cops thought I'd stolen my rental car, but I hadn't. I was wearing a vintage red patent leather vinyl trench coat and on the way to the theater. That was the only time I've sat in the back of a cop car. It was pretty awkward for everyone involved. I'd miss the interaction between people on the sidewalks if I lived in L.A. You don't see as many people strolling, lovers throwing their heads back and with their arms around each other, or someone smiling because it's spring or the sun's come out. I tripped in my clogs on the pavement in the Village, and a few people came to help me get up. When friends from the South come to visit, they're surprised how nice New Yorkers are. If I tripped in L.A. I remember turning over in a hammock once with my friend Jason at some Hollywood party. I think it was Charlie Sheen's, and falling splat onto the grass. We cracked up laughing, and people looked at us mortified. Anywhere else, say, in a backyard in Louisiana, people would laugh along, thinking, this is a fun party. You guys look like you're having a lot of fun. But L.A. is not a good place to fall. I think this was when Jason started saying, good luck with your project, instead of goodbye, when we left places. After a couple of months in L.A., I returned home to New York and went to some party where I was introduced to someone who said, I'm sure you don't remember, but we've met before, which I get all the time. And I feel bad that I don't remember the person's name. And I usually say, I'm sorry, I don't remember. Yeah, at this point I've met everyone, or we're all connected, or it's a small world, isn't just a ride at Disney World. I don't like this feeling of being put on the spot with a you probably don't remember me opener, because it's assumptive and can be tinged with a condescending attitude. I like to close that up real quick with a, you're probably right because you know why, and then they'll say why, and I'll say, because every moment is new, like now. And now is the only moment that exists, which is the truth. I get all shut down and cosmically defensive and guilty. But this time I said, no, I don't remember if we've met before, but we can meet now. What is your name and where did we meet? I'm sorry, I don't remember you. My life's had a lot of traffic and has cast a wide net. And he said, you asked me if I was a vegan as I was crossing the street in L.A. 19. Moving. Moving is emotional. Did you know the root of the word emotion means to move out? The move out of my last apartment came at middle age and introduced the perimenopausal puppet troupe forming inside me. Their laughter and tears, elation and exhaustion, manifesting in a shallow puddle of sweat on my chest in the middle of the night, was exciting and maybe nervous. I am alive and in this body. Great job, everybody. Now let's clean those sweaty costumes and you can all go home. Nora told me to freeze my eggs at lunch at Barney's the last time I saw her, and I stood up and walked to the kitchen. She mentioned then how she got her hair blown out twice a week, and that one day I would have to get work done. People in my business look at you like you don't care enough to wash your face if you don't do something. Truth is, people have great skin who've never washed their face. Who cares? No one. So, full circle, I got this ultrasound thing on my face and neck, and it's so painful and stupidly expensive, but I gave birth to new collagen. I would need to keep this going for my entire career, and it cost as much as my monthly maintenance and mortgage combined in my old apartment on Lower Fifth Avenue, the neighborhood that's called the Gold Coast, and not affectionately. I never heard anyone call it that until I left. I didn't want to do a CSI Neverland, so I decided to sell my apartment. I used myself in the photo for the ad. Live in the Gilded Age, it said. And I held Mary Louise Parker's book, Dear Mr. You, in my lap, pretending to read. This was a decision on my part that in the real estate world was considered gauche, but I knew times had changed, and this new Gilded Age was about famous people, celebrities. I ignored my celebrity as much as I could, but I wasn't going to now. The apartment felt more like a hotel.